Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is an associate professor of Spanish at California State University, Chico. Denise Miner tells a story of how she began as a language teacher almost three decades ago. She took a job because she was in Spain and needed the money, but she fell in love with teaching during that very first month. At that time, she never imagined she would one day get a PhD in Spanish linguistics, become a trainer of future Spanish teachers, and co-author a book about language teaching. That book is On Being a Language Teacher, A Personal and Practical Guide to Success. Denise Miner, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, college students sometimes anguish over selecting a major, and yet you didn't even begin to study Spanish until you were 25 years old.
That's right.
So what did you think you were going to do?
Well, in the beginning when I was in college, I thought that I wanted to be a lawyer. I was a political science major, and I took the LSAT and did well. And then I wanted a year off before going to law school. So my best friend and I hit the road. We went to Europe and bought a Eurail pass and traveled around. And as I was sitting on the trains thinking and thinking, I realized that I thought about what a person does for 8 hours, what their work is, not just what it appears to be from the outside. And I realized that the work I had been doing on the university newspapers was actually much more fun than what I imagined a lawyer would do. So I thought that's what I have to dedicate myself to.
And where is this university where you were an undergraduate?
I was at Boise State University in Idaho. That's where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I did that for a few years. I was a newspaper reporter.
So you decided, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, and it wasn't my major. My major was actually international relations, and the only thing I did with that was marry a Russian.
Oh. So do you speak Russian in addition to Spanish?
No, I tried. I studied it, and I understand quite a bit, especially the family kind of Russian that my husband speaks with his parents. But, I don't speak it. I used to speak a little bit better now, just barely, just a few phrases.
So you're traveling around in Europe, and you find yourself in Spain.
Oh, that was
a
years
trip.
Later. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. I was a reporter on newspapers in California and Massachusetts. And when I was 25, I was covering a very stressful beat, the City Hall in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I was involved with a man who was actually very selfish, and I knew I had to get out of the relationship. And for some time, I had been thinking that if I were going to live 80 years on this planet, I would like to be at least bilingual, and that if I didn't do it soon, it probably wouldn't happen. So I quit that job.
Your travel in Europe must have influenced that, because Europeans speak more than one language typically. I mean, it's fairly common.
Right.
And here we are, pretty much a monolingual country.
Right. Yeah, it did. It definitely impacted me. And I spoke some French and could get around in France. But I just decided that even though I spoke no Spanish, that's the language I wanted to learn. So I quit that job and left that boyfriend and moved to Spain, thinking that I would not only learn another language, but I would gather material for more stories. I didn't just like writing news articles. I liked writing fiction. I liked writing essays. So I thought that living abroad for a year would have a dual purpose.
So give you something to write about.
Yes. Exactly.
My guest is Denise Miner, and she teaches Spanish at Chico State University, and she's written a book about being a language teacher to help other teachers to learn, but she has tips for those of us who would like to be a language learner. So you find yourself in Spain,
mm-hmm.
and I was so interested in your book because when I was living in South America, in Peru, I was asked to teach English as a foreign language. And I loved it. I was already a teacher myself, but I really loved teaching English as a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you had a similar experience.
Yes, it sounds like it. I took work as an English teacher simply because I needed the money. I only had enough money to live on for a month, and I knew I had to find work. And I just had didn't think I would ever become a language teacher, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was teaching in this very small academy that was on the second floor above some kind of shop. And it had been a house, I believe, and the rooms had been turned into these tiny classrooms. And I had people that ran in age from like 12 to 60s or 70s. I couldn't tell then. And I barely spoke Spanish, so I had to use English. And it was really fun just getting my point across in one language and using the pantomiming and using the chalkboard to draw pictures and such.
In fact, I'm familiar with this part of Spain where you say in your book where you were when you mm-hmm. first began teaching. And it's a bilingual area anyway. People, yes. It's not Spanish, isn't the native the first language of a lot of the people where you were.
Right. It's Basque.
And signs are in two languages, at least two languages.
Right. Basque and Spanish. It's on the French border. A lot of people speak French as well. And a lot of people wanted to learn English. It wasn't uncommon to I taught private classes as well. In fact, I left the academy after a while and just did private lessons because I could make more money. And it wasn't uncommon to have a student who was learning English as their fourth language.
Well, you decide, yes, I want to be a language teacher.
Yes.
And then where did you go from there?
Then I moved back to San Francisco. I'd lived there for a while and after graduating from college, and I loved it. It was, for me, the best city I'd ever seen. And I little by little, started teaching private lessons, which is I taught private English in Spain. I began teaching private Spanish classes in the United States and enjoyed it very much. And I continued writing. I was a freelance writer. I wrote for the San Francisco Examiner and a few other papers. So I had kind of a dual career, dual income. But then I had never become really literate when I lived in Spain. I'd become very proficient. My Spanish got very good, but I wasn't good at writing. So I started taking classes at San Francisco State University, just thinking that I would improve my reading and writing.
You know what? I think that's what sometimes people who maybe don't speak a foreign language don't understand the differences in these levels. That just because you understand, say, mm-hmm. Spanish means you can write it or speak it well.
Right.
And those skills are so quite different.
They are very different. And, you know, I see that. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here if I talk about my students at Chico mm-hmm. State. Mm-hmm. But you see that, for instance, in people who speak Spanish as a home language, and they sound very fluent. Maybe they can't do some of the more difficult tenses, or maybe some of their vocabulary is limited and they use English words for it. But, you know, very fluent nonetheless. And they check into Spanish classes and they struggle with the reading and writing because that's not what they've been doing their whole lives. They've been reading and writing in English.
Well, for example, a word that comes to mind is the word mucho, which mm-hmm. a lot of Anglos know that word, M-U-C-H-O. Mm-hmm. And I would see native speakers putting an N in mucho.
Right.
And I would think you would get that commonly, too.
Yes, yeah.
And no matter how many times I corrected mucho, uh-huh. I would still get it in the next paper, instead of mucho.
Right. It's a colloquialism. It's very much just part of rural Mexican Spanish.
So you had quite a task in front of you to help people who spoke it. And I'm sure Anglos in the class would think, oh, golly, this guy's got such an advantage because he already speaks Spanish. What's he doing in this class?
Oh, yes, all the time.
And they wouldn't realize that they were there because they wanted to be literate
right.
in Spanish.
And the thing is, our grades are mostly based on the written material. So a lot of the Anglo students who start at the beginning and they are learning how to read and write from the very beginning. Sometimes their writing is way better than their speaking. So they'll get these good grades on their papers and their tests, and then a heritage speaker, that's what we call someone who speaks a language as a home language, like Spanish or Hmong, they might not do so well on the test and be very embarrassed about it. But yes.
In fact, when I first arrived in Peru, this language teacher was going to be teaching a class, and she gave us all a test, which was written, which was grammar. Mm-hmm. And I did quite well on the written. I couldn't say anything. I could understand, but I couldn't speak, really. Mm-hmm. I had no fluency in the language. And I think my scoring well on a grammar test led her to believe I knew a lot of Spanish, but right. It was totally different skills. Being
yes,
able
they
to
are.
Score well on a grammar test is quite different from being able to be fluent
yes,
in the language
and have a conversation.
At that level and have a conversation.
Yeah. Exactly.
My guest is Professor Denise Miner. She's written a book on being a language teacher, and we have you at this point in your career. You've begun taking Spanish classes to become a teacher, and you were in San Francisco at that time.
Yes, I wasn't taking classes so much to become a teacher, just to improve my Spanish, and I suppose I thought then I could teach higher levels as well. But I really got hooked on these classes. They had a good program, and I thought, why not keep going? Why not get a master's degree? And it took a while because I had to take all of the requirements for a bachelor's, you know, the undergraduate classes, and then the master's. So it took me 4 years, but I enjoyed every minute of it. I loved going to class. And while I was in the program, I was chosen first as a TA. I would teach with a professor. We would split the load. And then I became an instructor, and I had my own TA for the last year that I was there. And I loved that just as much as I've loved, you know, my other jobs teaching.
Well, I can also understand your interest in the language itself as opposed to, say, the literature, which most people, if they get a degree, and I think a lot of students coming out of high school say, oh, I love Spanish, I'll get a degree in Spanish, and realize, oh, this is all about literature, and I wanted to learn the language. And that was my interest as I came through school. I was interested in languages, mm-hmm. And I understand your interest, too, because I was interested in linguistics. I also took the LSAT, the law school admission test.
Really? Uh-huh.
I went to law school and realized, no, this is not what I want to do, so I didn't stay with that. But I started out my undergraduate as an English major. I had I took Latin, 2 years of Latin in high school, but I hadn't taken any modern languages until I got to college. So I discovered also a love for foreign languages, and I think you thought maybe you would be an English major maybe at some point, but I realized my first quarter at school, I don't think I want to study English.
Oh, yeah.
It's not literature that I'm interested in, it's language. And
right.
Words and all of the same things that I see in your book that mm-hmm. I think, wow, this is so interesting.
Well, thank you very much.
So then you, I think another thing too on this point of being a teaching assistant mm-hmm. is sometimes when parents are trying to help their say high school students select a college, they think, oh, well, go to this big prestigious university. You'll have prestigious professors and famous professors, and not realize, no, their first year, they're going to get teaching assistants. They're
right.
not going to see the big name professors.
Right.
And for that reason, I would like your opinion on when high school students select a college, maybe a smaller, maybe a community college,
mm-hmm.
maybe not a research university.
Right.
And see advantages in that.
Oh, I really see advantages in going to a community college because the people that will be your teachers there, that is the level that they love to teach. That's why they've gone into this job that they have. And I taught at a community college for a few years as well. And plus, it's so much better of a deal. It doesn't cost as much. You're less likely to come out of school with a debt. But I can say that at Chico State, you're really very, very likely, even as a freshman, to have a few professors mm-hmm. as your teachers. Mm-hmm. We have a high percentage of classes that are taught by professors. A lot of people might be thinking of going to a UC, and they should know. I think our UC system is wonderful, but they should know that they probably won't get a professor until maybe their senior year, except for in large lecture classes.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was getting my PhD at UC Davis and I was a TA there, in some of my evaluations, I would have students write, this is the first professor I've ever made a connection with. And I thought that was so sad.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't
a
professor. It's just human nature. You're more invested in the higher level that you teach, it seems to me. Not that I'm at Chico State and teaching Spanish majors, particularly when I teach the methodology class, which is my specialty, I think a lot more about them than I think about my beginning Spanish students. At night, I'm going over classes in my head or how much extra time I'm willing to give. It's just natural that I'm going to be a little bit more dedicated to my majors. you know. So.
Well, another thing we have in common is we were both teaching assistants, teaching mm-hmm. language, and you said when you stepped in that classroom, you had no experience as a teacher. You had to figure things out for yourself.
Yes.
And undergraduate and graduate school, I spent a year teaching high school students. So I did have that background. But that was my favorite part of graduate school, really, was the teaching of those classes.
Yeah.
And after the first quarter, I was asked to teach a more advanced level.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. And when my husband started teaching, he had a PhD, I had more teaching experience than he did.
Wow.
He had no, I mean, he was trained, PhDs are trained as researchers, not as beginning language teachers.
Well, that is changing. And one of the reasons this book was written was for those classes that they now give, those methodology classes that they give brand new graduate students who come into a program and are assigned a beginning level class. My co-author, Norma Lopez-Burton, that's what she does at UC Davis. She trains all of the beginning level Spanish TAs. And she was really dissatisfied with all of the textbooks out there. Some of them were so thick that the only people who were really interested in them were the linguistics mm-hmm. specialists. Mm-hmm. The literature, the people who were specializing in literature, which is the vast majority, they wouldn't even read the book. They'd admit to her a year later.
Yeah.
So she set out, it was her idea to write this book. She set out wanting to write a book for those classes that are taught throughout the country to train those TAs who teach the first year of Spanish, French, whatever the mm-hmm. case.
Because in your case, you were just thrown into the classroom,
yeah.
figure this out for yourself, Denise.
Right, right. And that's the way it used to be for TAs.
Oh,
but
yeah.
now there
yeah,
has
when
been,
I was.
There has been a big change in that. They are training them. They don't have any, many of them have no experience when they step in the first time to teach their first semester because they're taking that class concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time they get to their second semester, they're a little bit better. But yeah, I was the senior TA, and I helped her train TAs, and I would go observe them, and I saw some terrible classes. I used would sit in the back and think, if the parents only knew what they were paying for.
Oh, yeah.
But usually with some counseling, with some help, those TAs figured it out after a year or so.
Well, I used to be an advisor to college students, freshmen at Indiana University, and they would come in and say, my math teacher's from India and I can't understand a word he's saying. His English was so poor. Then even if it was math they were trying to learn,
mm-hmm.
they were having a hard time just communicating with the teaching assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And it varies so much. Like, you loved teaching, and so you get a teaching assistant who loves teaching, you're in luck.
Mm-hmm.
But not all of them are there for that.
Right. And they have no intention of teaching beginning level classes in the future. You know, they've got their sights set on teaching literature.
Mm-hmm. My guest is co-author of a book on being a language teacher. Her name is Denise Miner, and she teaches Spanish at Chico State University. Now, last fall, I happened to be in a little town in France, and there was a bookstore that sold old books. And my traveling companion said, oh, let's see if they have some books in English. So the store was so packed and stacked with books that you could hardly walk in there. So I just waited at the door. And when they came back out, the owner of the bookstore was so delighted. A book on Noam Chomsky.
Oh.
The fact that we were interested or even knew who Noam Chomsky was. She said, let's go to lunch. She said, I'm going to close the shop. I'm going to call a friend. The four of us will go have lunch. And she was so enthusiastic about the fact that we knew who Noam Chomsky was.
Uh-huh.
So for those people who might not know who Noam Chomsky is, why did you mention him in your book?
Well, Chomsky revolutionized the field of linguistics. That's why I start the chapter on theory with him, because I think that more than anyone else, he changed the way we think. And now that started in the 50s when he published Syntactic Structures. But he's also famous as a political activist, probably more famous.
And this is what this French woman was interested
yeah.
in, because she wanted to talk politics with Americans.
Yeah.
Because the fact that we could speak French means she could tell us her opinions and ask us ours. So
right.
that was her interest in Noam
yeah,
Chomsky.
He was at the forefront of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era. And even, you know, when we have gone into the Middle East, he's a very outspoken pacifist and social activist. So one of the reasons I like to start with Chomsky and teach people about Chomsky is because I have some very interesting clips. For one thing, his life is so interesting. And what I found is that my students remembered. They remembered his theories because they remembered him. They saw him as a human being, an interesting human being, and it helped them learn his theories about universal grammar and about, you know, the black box that we carry in our head that helps us assimilate a language. Whereas with some of the other research, some of the other famous people in the area of linguistics, they couldn't get their hooks into it. I mean, they might get it memorized for a test, but then not be able to talk about it, you know, 6 months later. But Chomsky stuck, and I thought, that's how I'm going to start that chapter, because people like him. They like hearing about him. They like knowing about him.
And he's had such a long career.
Oh, yeah. He's still teaching.
Astounding. Yes.
Yeah, he's still. I've heard that he is still in that big old office at MIT that is stuffed with books that are some of them falling apart.
And something I learned in your book that I didn't happen to know, that his father was a linguist.
Yes, his father was
a
linguist.
So he's kind of born into
right.
royalty.
Well, what's interesting, his father was a linguist and his mother was an activist.
Yes.
Yeah, a political activist.
Yes, and that also I found interesting.
And he became both.
Yes, he did. You describe him as a linguist, a philosopher, a cognitive science, a historian, mm-hmm. and an activist. That's pretty amazing. So what was the revolution then that Chomsky, how did he change the way language was taught?
Before Chomsky, most people thought of language as something that you learn, the way you learn to play the trombone or learn about mathematics or history, that it was much more a cognitive skill. But Chomsky proposed that it's not like that at all. It's an instinct, just like walking is an instinct, that we were born with this innate ability to simply assimilate it. We don't have to learn it. We just soak it in as children. And he proposed that languages, teachers often focus on all of the differences, but really they're all extremely similar. They have the similar parts of speech. They serve similar functions, that all the languages that exist in the world are actually just outward manifestations of the same system that resides inside of our brain.
My guest is co-author of a book on being a language teacher. She is Professor Denise Miner. She teaches at California State University, Chico. So people come to you because they're going to get a class, a formal class. But so many people want to learn language at home. And now that we have computers, we have access to programs like the Rosetta Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that helps people?
I think that they do help people. Some people consider it very fun to engage with these programs that have been developed. Some of them are really good, really interactive. But I do warn them that you can never get past a certain stage without interacting with human beings, because that's what language is meant to do. It is a tool for interacting with humans, and you can't have a true interaction with a computer, I don't think. No, I haven't seen the study, so maybe if I investigate this a little bit further, I'll feel differently. But I think I look at them more as something that supports your learning. And you don't have to go out and enroll in a class to get the practice with human beings. You can find other venues. For instance, at Chico State, we have free conversation hours once a week in, I hope I remember all the languages. I'll be embarrassed if I don't. Spanish, which is usually Monday evenings, and German, French, Japanese, Italian, and Portuguese. And forgive me if I've forgotten one. But if anyone's interested, they can find out about them, where they are, when, from the Department of International Languages, Cultures, and Literatures. Oh, wait. Literatures and Culture. Sorry. We changed our name last year, and I sometimes transpose the words. but there, you can just go to that once a week. We have a lot of community people who show up and talk. And I believe the Peace and Justice Center, they used to have a Spanish conversation hour. You can also, you know, the best thing you can do is make a friend. So if you want to use one of those programs like the Rosetta Stone, I would say you need to also
supplement it.
Make that your main focus. Speak to humans.
Well, that's a wonderful service you offer the community.
Yes.
These conversation groups.
Right.
And do they usually meet in the evenings?
Yes. Very often, for instance, the Spanish, last semester was Mondays, 5:30, 6:30. We like to keep it consistent. But I have been in charge of that for 8 years. And for the last, say, five, I've been working with TAs. I train TAs to run them. And we have two levels, the beginning tables and the intermediate advanced tables.
Oh, that's a good idea, because I do know of conversation groups here in town, and there's such a disparity in the level. There are people there who want to listen and hear, and they can't really say anything. And then there are people who are so fluent that they kind of overpower the others.
Yes.
So that's wonderful. You have separate tables for beginners and, say, intermediates.
I was finding, I don't know what it's like for the other languages, but I was finding it just did not work to have one conversation hour for everybody. Nobody was getting served well. Mm-hmm. So by having, usually I have three TAs each semester, and by having them work with people individually, if it's necessary, if you have a couple of really advanced people, and then the other two will take the beginning group. So they have to make these on-the-spot decisions, but with three of them, it always seems to work, and we come with a lot of activities planned, and then adjust them depending on who's there, what their level is, how many people. So, yeah, I would encourage anyone who's interested in practicing Spanish in the fall to look into that.
Spanish or one of these other languages.
Yes, German, French, as I said, Japanese, Portuguese, Italian. Yeah,
well,
I think that's it.
Tell listeners again what department, how do they contact the university?
Oh, gosh, I wish I had the number memorized.
Well, no, just the name of it again.
The Department of International Languages, Literatures, and Cultures.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned culture, too, and that's such a part of learning a language. You have a section in your book mm-hmm. where you answer that question, why teach culture?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not typically on an exam. You're not tested on that. But but it's so important to understand the culture.
Yes. That is now many people who specialize in methodology, pedagogy, realize that it's an integral part of learning a language and that it has to the chapters need to be infused with that kind of knowledge and that kind of information. So you don't just have, for instance, a few little boxes that are separate of cultural readings and then ignore it the rest of the time. If you're working, for instance, on the preterite, which is one of the past tenses of Spanish, you could use it to talk about something that happened in the past, some very important historical event, and why it's important to the people of Mexico or of Spain.
And I might add, this conversation about the culture is in Spanish, because you don't let your students speak English. Or if they speak English in class, you have a system in your book that's quite delightful. I wish we had time to go into that. But at the end of the semester, they get rewarded if they've spoken much more Spanish and less English in the classroom.
Right. I have a box on the board, and if I hear any English, I put a mark in the English box. If they do a good job speaking Spanish, they get a mark in the Spanish box, and then I keep a running tally. And it really works to incentivize them to stay in Spanish. If they get 100 points by the end of the semester, everyone's grade goes up, everyone's final grade.
And they get rewarded with a fiesta.
And a party, yes. That's also a part of it.
It's been so delightful talking to you, Denise.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Denise Miner. She is co-author of On Being a Language Teacher, A Personal and Practical Guide to Success. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.